From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, Bankstown? Hey, how we doing?
And that'll do it. It's over. The Golden State Warriors return to a familiar place. They're on top of the NBA world. The fourth title in 8 years. The Dubs dynasty is still very much alive.
He's Blank, I'm Branham, Brendan behind the glass. It is a Friday edition of the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Golden State Warriors winning the NBA Finals. Back to the, what did Draymond call it, the Warrior Invitational?
Yep.
As Golden State wins their fourth title in 8 seasons. Steph Curry named the NBA Final MVP, which certainly adds to his legacy, and it adds the victory to the Golden State Warrior dynasty.
Yeah, look, a great win for the Warriors, and when you look at it, it's a matter of opinion, I guess, in terms of how much Steph still had to prove. But to watch that guy, especially with his small stature, carry that team on his back for the majority of that series, and then what he was able to do again last night, and it didn't just solidify the Warriors, it solidified Steph at a different level in terms of not just the greatest shooter of all time, which I think pigeonholes him, but I think just watching him again, the degree of difficulty on the shots that he made last night was just, in certain regards, like with Pritchard hanging all over him, coming off a screen in the corner, where he just kind of gyrated his body and still made the shot. And it's like, you know what, man? You have to appreciate all the different ways this guy can make shots.
A lot of people are talking about the legacy of Steph Curry today after mm-hmm. Winning another title, after being one of the only players to win an NBA Finals at his age into the mid-30s. And watching the game and then watching the series, it always have been very high on Steph Curry and where he ranks in terms of all-time greats. And I'm not a huge list guy. I think that they're very arbitrary. I think it depends a lot on personal bias. There's also different ways to talk about him. You can talk about resume, you can talk about eye test, you can talk about quality of the player, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But watching that, and I know that we brought up Kobe Bryant the other day, mm-hmm. I don't see how Steph Curry is not a better offensive player all time than Kobe Bryant. Ooh. I think that Steph Curry has passed Kobe, and look, I think it's very imperative to say offensive players, because Steph does get docked for his defense. Yep. Steph is not a very good defensive player. Teams hunt Steph Curry, if we're being completely honest, on the offensive side of the ball, where Kobe Bryant was all-time, NBA first-team defense year in, year out. Very good defender. He was great on both sides of the floor. So I'm not really willing to put Steph ahead of Kobe all-time overall, but in terms of scoring the basketball, Steph Curry is a more efficient scorer and offensive player than Kobe Bryant ever was.
And that's fair for you to say that. I disagree simply because of the fact of the different ways that Kobe would beat you in terms of how many times I saw him be super clutch. I mean, with guys draped all over him, with, the worst case scenario of being down 9 with just 30 seconds or less and just, continuing to hit shot after shot after shot, or go over someone and dunk on them, or, go in and take punishment and still finish and go to the line. So it's no slap in the face to Steph Curry by any means in my regard, but I just think I saw Kobe at a different level. I know he beat my teams consistently. I watched his entire career, and I just think that as good as Steph is, and it's not just shooter from three. I mean, he's the greatest three-point shooter, but he may be the greatest pure shooter that we've ever seen in any lifetime. But in terms of how that translates to winning games, clutch shots, guys, taking punishment, guys draped all over you as well, It's a fair argument to have, but I would go Kobe.
Steph has more MVPs. Yep. He has 2 compared to Kobe's 1. Now, Kobe was a 5-time champion. Curry just won his 4th, still playing part of his career. Look, maybe Curry never gets another one, so maybe he does finish.
Got a good shot.
I do too. But so that would help the argument there too. But if you're talking about right now, just 4. Now, NBA Finals MVP, Steph Curry has 1, picked up the 1 yesterday. Kobe Bryant has 2 over the course of his career. I think Curry was actually robbed in 2015 not to win that MVP. He was far better
statistically. That was Iguodala?
That was Iguodala, whenever he was given credit for defending LeBron James, who averaged nearly 40 points per game in that series. I would have given LeBron the MVP before I'd have given Iguodala the MVP. So Curry only has 1. I thought he was robbed in 2015, but he only has 1. Regular season numbers, pretty close. I just mentioned the MVPs, 2-1 Curry advantage. They're both 2-time scoring champions as well. So relative to the era they've played in, 2-time scoring champion for both of them. Curry, 24 points a game. Kobe, 25, so slight lead there. But Curry, more assists, 6.5 to Kobe's 4.7. And Curry, a better shooter, 47% from the field. Kobe was 45, so not bad, not that big a difference. The biggest difference comes from behind the three-point line, where Curry was 43 and Kobe 33. Now, the playoffs, I think, like, adds to legacy, right? Like, if you're having all-time great discussions, I think the playoffs are something that matters. Curry averages one point more per game over the course of their career in the playoffs in terms of averages. Averages an assist and a half a game more than Kobe Bryant in terms of averages. Field goal percentage the same. Curry, much better three-point shooter. I look at the offensive side of the ball. I just think that Steph Curry far more efficient than Kobe as an offensive player. Because, look, the scoring's about the same, but Kobe not as good a passer as Curry.
But you just got done rattling off of all the – and I think as much as those stats can matter if we're talking about who's the better player all time, if we're just talking about the better offensive player –
right, that's why I phrased it that way.
Yeah, I think that you just look at the fact that – Right off the top, hands down, you say Steph's a better three-point shooter. You just know. I mean, his range from anywhere and the way that he just he gets it off and is able to make shots. And I'd say that's where Steph's deficiency would be in the fact that inside the three-point line, you don't see him do that as much or take on the same two defenders they have when they protect the perimeter.
Curry's pretty good at getting to the rim, though, and finishing at the rim.
And he can get inside, but I'm just saying in terms of Kobe taking the mid-range, and then on top of that, taking punishment. But you're right, in terms of – and Kobe had the ability to finish on you, dunking it and do other things. Steph's more savvy, right? He'll use his body to create angles and things. He has great spin off the glass to be able to finish his shots. So, like I said, you can go – I can see guys going on both sides of this. I just – for watching Kobe as long as I did, I think he was almost underappreciated. It's why I always bring him up as a guy that's just a forgotten conversation piece when you're talking about LeBron and Michael.
What's interesting when looking at Kobe, too, is that, like, you mentioned the mid-range game, because his mid-range game, post-up game, is better than Steph Curry. But also, the game has evolved and changed to where it now tells you that the mid-range game and, like, shots outside of the paint really aren't that efficient of shots. So it's like, it's very interesting looking back, because even Jordan was a very good, like, post-scorer.
Oh, yeah.
He was taking turnaround 15-footers all game long and shooting from the elbows all game long. So it's interesting looking at the two different dynamics between the two. But I'm not sure offensively what Kobe Bryant was better at in the aggregate, the overall. Like, yeah, he had a better post-game. But would you take the post-game versus Steph Curry knocking down 10% of his three-pointers at a higher rate? And it's also more points, right? So very different styles. But if you're looking at one specific offensive player, at least in my opinion, I'm putting Curry ahead of Kobe, which I think would probably be blasphemous for a lot of people.
It might stir some feathers up. I think that, like I said, in terms of the clutch shots, the ability to make clutch shots, big shots, game-winning shots, he carried his team in the finals this year. I think in a lot of times when Kobe insisted on staying with the Lakers and waiting for the organization to give him more help and do other things, he basically carried entire teams for entire seasons and more. And you can go back and say, there were years when the Warriors had injuries and they weren't a playoff team in the two other years of the 8 years of this run. And you could be critical of Steph for that. I'm not that guy. I'm not trying to be critical of Steph. I'm just here to basically support the fact that from game winners, clutch shots, carrying a team on his back, and the ability to take the punishment as well when he scored from the mid-range game is where I would give Kobe some extra credit.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that last part, but could you point to that part of the game? And look, it was a different game, so I'm not blaming Kobe for that. But, like, maybe not looking back in hindsight, the most optimal thing that Kobe could do. Like, would he have been better suited playing? I mean, it's tough to say. Like, I'm not going to say play like Steph Curry, because you didn't want Kobe Bryant shooting as many threes as Steph Curry shooting, because Kobe wasn't a great three-point shooter, or as Steph Curry is. But maybe not taking the abuse would have not led to the decline of Kobe Bryant
it's
later
possible,
in his career.
But like you said, it's two different eras. The game was called two different ways. And I think we're passing judgment right now based on the rules the way they stand today, whereas that's where you could flip the script too and say, I don't think that if Steph played in the era when Kobe was getting the crap beat out of him a lot of nights with the double teams and things, that he might have had the same level of success or shooting percentage because he'd have gotten the crap beat out of him.
That's why it's hard for me to compare eras. Like, everybody wants to talk about all-time great list, and it's like, okay, well, Jordan was dominating in games in which they scored, like, in the 80s. You know what I mean? As opposed to nowadays where they're scoring in the 120s. So it's hard to compare, stats from, the NBA now where you're in the 120 points every single game versus back in Jordan's day whenever you were in the 80s and just, going era to era. Now, I think what's an interesting conversation to this as well, 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Like Corey saying, I feel Steph had more teammates he could trust in his career for getting assists. Like the Laker teams, whenever Kobe was winning versus the Golden State run here where they've won 4 times in 8 years, I would put the Lakers with Shaq ahead of the Golden State Warriors, but then the Lakers with like Paul Gasol and Lamar Odom,
right.
I would have after the Golden State
Correct.
Warriors.
I would
so,
agree.
So if you're looking at like those three different eras for the dynasties that both of these players had, I think Kobe had the best team because I think he had the best player in Shaq. I would pick Shaq over Kevin Durant, and Kevin Durant was only around for half of
the
titles.
But you also have to consider the other intangible was Golden State really gets along well, and basically there's no infighting. There's a lot of team chemistry. That kind of lends itself to the style of basketball that they play with trusting your teammates, the movement without the ball, things like that. I mean, the stories go endless about those Shaq-Kobe teams. It wasn't just Shaq versus Kobe. Mm-hmm. It was everyone in that locker room was like fighting with everybody on a daily basis, and they say that the one championship against the Pistons that they felt like they should have won,
right.
But because after every finals game, it was like a bloodbath in the Lakers locker room, even when they won.
See, I was thinking about that too, because you always talk about the, okay, let's replace the two players in the conversation with each other. Like, I think the Steph Curry-Shaq teams still win titles, and I think that would have been a very great duo. I still think that, like, the Lakers wouldn't have missed a beat if you swap out Kobe Bryant and Steph Curry from that first run. The Golden State Warriors, do they win 4 titles in 8 years with Kobe Bryant? I don't know. Like, the fact that the ball, like, gets a little sticky in his hands might not be a great thing for Golden State.
But he's also a savvy enough, smart basketball player to realize if there were guys on his team that he truly trusted, that he would get them the basketball. He trusted Derek Fisher. He got guys the ball when they were open. But I think in a lot of cases, in some of those that team below the Warriors level, right. The Odom-Gasol team, I don't think he trusted a whole lot of guys on that team.
See, that's where I'm at. Like, Curry was Shaq, the first, dynasty for the Lakers. That team doesn't miss a beat. They still win a lot of games. Kobe with Golden State, I still think that they probably get this dynasty too, but I'm not as sure as Steph with Shaq. In terms of Steph with Lamar and Steph with Paul, I don't think that's who wins it.
No, I don't think so. But here's my other question too. Do you believe that Kobe and KD are similarly in terms of what they brought to a team? Because if you can win with KD, you could win with Kobe.
Sure, but Steph was still on the KD team.
Okay, yeah, I mean, right. But I'm saying if they were able to adapt and put Kevin Durant in that Warriors, I think that, and you think that Kobe could adapt the way Kevin Durant could, I feel like Kobe could slide in from a Kevin Durant standpoint, even without Steph. And he would trust Klay Thompson for sure.
Yeah, it would have been fun to see. Curry or Durant?
Right now, I think you got. I think talent-wise, I think it's Durant. I think that resume-wise, it's Curry.
I think it's the two different conversations. Yeah. Resume, you can't compare. Steph by a mile. In terms of like the eye test and in like the body of work, you would think Durant.
I thought Barkley made a hell of a comment this morning, and he's right. Look, as much as everybody gives the deserved credit to Kevin Durant for his abilities, until he wins one by himself as the lead dog, then there's not a lot of conversation.
It's almost Kobe with Paul and Lamar. Not quite that example, because Kobe won a lot with Shaq, but it's almost to that point.
Because people
Kevin
are going to point to OKC and said, you should have. You were that good. You should have won a team with that team in OKC.
Especially up 3-1, right? 713-780-ESPN. We'll take your thoughts on this. 713-780-3776. Also, when we return, Astros pitching staff is very deep. That's great for the regular season. But does it lack the elite arms that you might think you would need for the postseason? We'll discuss that when we return. Skiller Reese on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5. You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
We'll talk NBA a little bit later. We'll talk that with Sam Amico, senior NBA writer, at 1 o'clock. Get his thoughts on the NBA Finals, the legacy of not only Golden State, but Steph Curry. We'll also get his thoughts on the Christian Wood trade and what the Rockets might be looking to do with 3 first-round draft picks coming up in less than a week. But yesterday we had Jim Duquette on, former general manager of the New York Mets, former general manager of the Baltimore Orioles. And he was talking about something that I think we've had an ongoing conversation about. And I think this actually like speaks towards your argument of this, because like the Astros pitching staff that they have right now, it's very deep. Like there's not really much weakness on this team. Like we might gripe about what Jose Urquidy's doing out of the fifth, sixth, seventh starting spot on this team. But overall, the Astros have a top three ERA in the baseball. The bullpen with whoever is throwing out there is getting the job done in terms of ERA and preventing runs. Maybe they stress you out over the, you know, during the innings that they're in. But the question that I have is, like, this is a good regular season staff. They're going to be top five in ERA throughout the entire regular season. But does it lack the elite arms that you would need in the postseason? Because you got Justin Verlander, who I would consider elite. You consider him elite, I'm sure, right?
Yep.
Framber Valdez, would you consider him an elite arm? See, I think he's on the cusp, but probably not there, right?
Like, it's just, it's the sample size again. Until he starts to, look, this little run he's been on in the regular season has been good at convincing us he's turned a corner, but you just don't know for sure until you see it in the playoffs.
To me, he pitches elite at times, but there's other times he does not. And whereas Justin Verlander, he can get to that spot more often. He's more consistent with it. So that's why you would give JV that level, that label and not Framber. How about Lance McCullers Jr.?
Again, can be, but he also just, look, he's got a great arm, but to be elite, it's your arm and your mind, and it's putting everything together and execution. So I would say it's kind of along the same framework as Framber.
I would too. I think he's more of the Framber mold than he is the Justin Verlander mold. I don't think anyone in the bullpen is what you would call elite. I think you have some elite arms there, but they're not quite elite level in terms of what you trust them to do or expect them to do at this point. Do you think there's anybody in the bullpen that you would call elite? I think they're all good across the board. I wouldn't say that any of them are like shut down Trevor Hoffman elite.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that, again, not that you're saying Hall of Fame level, but you're looking at like a, you know, a guy that's just going to be, as it relates to the era you're currently in, one of the best closers or one of the best setup guys or, you know, situational lefties. I don't see those kind of arms like maybe in the past you've seen some of those guys in the bullpen. So I would say no.
Here was Jim Duquette on with us yesterday talking about the pitching staff and talking about the depth of this pitching staff in terms of what it regards to the postseason.
You know, anytime we're watching teams that go deep into the postseason, you first have to start with their overall pitching, both starting in bullpen and then also the defense. And I think that, you know, from an Astros side of things, you know, the defense I need to see a little bit more of, but I think they clearly have enough pitching to have a deep run again.
So that was Duquette yesterday. The defense has been very good for the Astros up until this past weekend in terms of like runs saved and things like that, those nerdy metrics that I like to take a look at. But I agree with Duquette in the sense that this pitching staff is deep. But the question that I would ask and where I would push back Duquette a little bit here is, do you need more elite arms? Because I think we identified one, maybe one and a half, if you want to throw Framber and Lance McCullers as like that half. Do the Astros have the elite arms necessary to make a deep run, to get to a World Series and win it for the second time in organization history?
See, this is what I was kind of alluding to when we were talking about this yesterday, is the fact that when you look at a Mets team that could put DeGrom and Scherzer out there, when you look at even just some of the old Astros teams, and we were talking about going back in history, the staff that had Oswalt, Clemens, and Pettit all on the same staff, you know, and the Astros of Verlander and Pettit, I mean, Verlander and Cole, you know, you could go up and down and go, there's always a 1A, 1B when you on a lot of the really great teams that we're talking about. That was my biggest concern. It's not that they don't have quality arms. It's not that they don't have a good young pitching staff for a regular season or that they have guys that are going to be above average starters for 162 games. But the playoffs, as we all know, is a different animal, and it takes a different mentality. It takes a different ability, and it takes a different kind of gut check ability to be able to suck it up and kind of fight through those high leverage situations that maybe won't be higher in their careers.
See,
and only certain guys can do that.
To me, it's case by case. To me, it's like based on the year. Like if you want to go back to last year's World Series, because look, I much rather have more elite arms than not have elite arms. But if you don't have three elite arms, I don't think it disqualifies you from having the opportunity of getting through and winning
three,
the World Series.
But two is really ideal.
Two would be great. If you want to look at just this recent Astros, like golden era as the example of what different staffs look like 2019 would speak to the year that you're talking about where the Astros had elite arms. Because Justin Verlander was an elite arm and Garrett Cole was an elite arm. And then you had some good pieces around them. Like you had Ozuna, who, you know, is a kind of a polarizing name, who was still very good out of the bullpen. You had Ryan Stressly around at that time, too. Will Harris was a very good pitcher in 2019. So I think 2019 would be the best example, if you look at the three World Series teams, that had multiple elite arms. 2017, I don't think you had multiple elite arms in 2017 whenever you got to the World Series and won it. You had Justin Verlander as one. Like, is Charlie Morton, is Lance McCullers, are they in the mold of what you would consider
Charlie
elite?
Charlie Morton's not necessarily an elite arm.
He's borderline.
But
he's Fromber Lance.
But he's borderline in terms of, besides what, take the arm alone out of it, in terms of the stuff and the ability to pitch through stuff, I think that's where Charlie Morton gets maybe not enough credit.
I would agree with that.
To elevate him.
Like, you had Keuchel that year. Keuchel was not...
That was when he was still good.
Very good, but not an elite arm, right? Like, right. He's a solid pitcher who right. you would love to throw out there in a you know, best of seven that's going to give you five quality
innings. And on a team that good, he could be an all-star.
Sure, absolutely. And he was. I mean, he
right,
was great.
That's what I mean.
He was very good that year. You had Lance McCullers, who also was very good in the first half of that year. Wasn't as great the second half. But then you look at the bullpen of 2017. Ken Giles was a disaster in the playoffs. Davinsky was good at that time, but it's Chris Davinsky. Yep. Luke Gregerson, Michael Feliz, Will Harris was solid, but it's Will Harris. Joe Musgrove was actually on that team, too. And Tony Sipp. And then you go back and you look at last year's World Series team. And look, I think the offense carried them a great extent. But last year, you probably didn't have any elite arms, right? You had Fromber and Luis Garcia as really your only two starters that you could trust.
And it wasn't the same Zach Greinke.
Right. It was not. Yeah, it was an aging Zach Greinke who, like, you were just hoping he can get by on, like, grit and know-how. But Fromber and Luis Garcia, you were hoping, like, we were having conversations. Can he give you three innings in one run today before you hand it off to the bullpen? And it's not like the bullpen last year was murderer's row. Like, Presley's a nice piece. He's not. I wouldn't consider him elite. Graveman's a nice piece. I wouldn't consider him elite either. So to me, it's year by year. Would you rather have the elite arms? Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think it disqualifies you as a contender.
No, it doesn't disqualify you, but I think it also makes the entire process a lot easier, because even if you don't have three, that's what I was saying, if you have two, you go back to the year that they had Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling in Arizona, they didn't really worry about their bullpen a whole lot, because they knew that they were going to have two guys that were going to go out and just absolutely eat up innings and blow people away for the majority of their starts. Therefore, your bullpen, that whatever you have in there, is going to be fresh. They're going to be ready. They're not going to be used a whole lot. And if your other starters give you at least close to a quality start, you got a pretty damn good chance to win. And since you're only going four deep and you only got to win four games as you got deeper into the playoffs, and you knew you were going to see those guys probably each twice, you were in pretty good shape.
Yeah. See, but like the Braves last year. Like, they to me had...
Yeah, that was a team that didn't have anybody that you would say is elite.
The Braves staff, to me, last year is kind of like the Astros staff this year, except the Astros have Verlander. Like, they have a lot of quality-ish arms, then have the elite arm with Justin Verlander, where the Braves didn't have that. But they also didn't have, like, weaknesses. You know
right.
what I mean?
Because you can go to the... And I was going to say, on the flip side example, but sometimes you have just too much, you go to the Braves during that run where they just couldn't, you know, where they couldn't get over the top and win a World Series, but they were every year. Mm-hmm. They literally had three and a half, right? Because Avery wasn't the fourth. But when you had Smoltz and you had Glavine and you had Maddox, it was like, well, good luck today, tomorrow, and the next day.
They always had a fourth pitcher, too, that would pop up. At first, it was Avery. Then remember Danny Nagel had a time whenever he was really good. And then they always had a really good closer. Like, they had a Rocker at a point where he was dominant for like 2 years, and then he went off the rails.
And Smoltz ended up converting from starter to be that closer later. But
they had a really good closer the first go-around, was, like early. I can't remember who it was. But
he had a beard.
It was before Rocker.
You know? I want to say it was... the guy that the majority of his career was in St. Louis.
It's not Isringhausen, was it?
No, yeah. I don't think so.
Isringhausen was wanting to come to my mind. Who was that first Braves closer that was dominant? 713-780-ESPN. Help us out. 713-780-3776. It was the first
late,
run where they were getting
90s?
To the World Series. I think it was early 90s. I'm talking to, like the first, right when they started winning division titles. I think it was before the strike. I think it was like 91, 92, 93. What do you think, Hive? What do you think, Houston? The Astros pitching staff, look, it's deep. But is it better suited for the regular season? Does this entire pitching staff lack the elite arms after Justin Verlander? And do they need to acquire some more elite arms to try to get them suited and prepared for a playoff run? You let us know. We'll take your reaction. 713-780-ESPN. 713-780-3776. Also, when we come back, look, would you trade one of those arms? Maybe not an elite arm, but would you trade from your surplus of arms to help you out offensively? Would you trade one of those arms for a bat? We'll talk about that when we return as well. It's Killer Beast on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Real fun sports. You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
We're talking about the Astros pitching staff. How many elite arms do you have in this Astros pitching staff? Do they have enough elite arms to make you comfortable for a playoff run? Do they need to add an elite arm to make you feel a little bit more comfortable? Adam's saying, I wouldn't mind trading for Charlie Morton. We were talking about Charlie Morton. Terrible year so far, blah, 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 blah. Here's the Braves are in the playoff race. Like, yeah. I don't see why the why Atlanta would be willing to quit on Charlie Morton.
They're not going to. And I think that, you know, when and we'll get into it at a certain point. Now we're going to start seeing, as we get, you know, into the dog days of summer and we get closer to that August 2nd trade deadline, you're going to see all the different teams, and they have to make some evaluations fairly quickly now about, are we going to go for it? Are we going to be in the – are we buying or selling? Are we in it to win it, or are we planning for the future and knowing that we've got pieces that might set us back in the short term but might really set us up for the long term? Because with the extra playoff spot, that's going to be even more interesting. More teams are going to have a chance, and as long as you got a chance, you're probably not going to be willing to part with guys – that are integral parts of this season's team, and that's going to hurt teams like the Astros that are looking for help and trying to get a team that's already folded up their tents to go home and go, hey, by the way, we got a couple guys in A or double A, or if you have to go to triple A, you know, that can help us now and we can help you down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I saw an article today, too, where I think it was Bowden for The Athletic had like 150 players that could be traded, and I was kind of skimming through it just to see what the market's going to look like coming up for the August 2nd trade deadline. First time in baseball history off that July 31st. I guess I shouldn't say history, at least in my lifetime. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Mark Wohlers, you looked it up. He was the Brave closer we were talking about right at the beginning of that dynasty, where Mark Wohlers was locking down the last few outs for the Atlanta Braves in that terrific dynasty. All right, so would you trade one of your arms? Because the Astros have a surplus of arms, right? And I think a lot of them are the same echelon of pitcher. Like, they're not the same guy. They all have different arsenal. They all have different stuff. But outside of Justin Verlander, I think you drop off a tier, right? In whenever I'm starting to outstep my bounds here, correct me. I think that Fromber and Lance McCullers are your second tier of pitchers. Mm-hmm. And very good pitchers. They would be, you know, number one, number two starters on most teams around Major League Baseball. And then I think you drop down a tier for Luis Garcia, for Christian Javier, and I think you might even drop down another tier for Urquidy and Overeasy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, you know, some of the other things that factor in from Odorizzi, it's kind of like the Yuli Bregman conversation when we're talking about how much leeway you give a guy. Well, you give Urquidy more leeway because he's younger, but you also are going to be more hypersensitive because he's had two major injuries to his shoulder in terms of concern-wise. He hasn't had the surgeries both times. Also had Tommy John surgery. So you're going to handle him with kid gloves, and a lot of teams are going to say he's damaged goods. We don't want to touch him. From an Odorizzi standpoint, it's just age. He's up in age. He's been there, done that. His fastball and his stuff isn't what it was when he was at his peak. So I think that changes things, not only if it's for the Astros or for anybody else that might be interested in it.
Yeah, he doesn't have a ton of value on the market, whereas like a Javier or a Garcia would. So when we were talking to Jim Duquette yesterday, we were asking him about the market, certain players, the Astros, what it might look like for James Click approaching that trade deadline on August 2nd. And Jim Duquette brought up an interesting idea that I think makes it difficult for Astro fans that might be wanting to add offense.
Boy, that's a tough call. You know, I think that, that's exactly what Baltimore's going to need for Mancini. So if there is one guy that you could give up, I'm not sure who that guy would be for Houston at the moment, but I would not hesitate. If you felt like he was more of a greater than a mid-rotation type starter, you know, and you know, that comes down to your own, knowing your own and your own evaluation. So I would under that circumstance, but, you know, again, not knowing necessarily who that player is, it's questionable just because you don't want to give up that long-term, you know, control of a pitcher that's so valuable for that rental. But you're going to have to give up something decent. And for me, that's where Houston is. They're that type of bat away from making another deep run and possibly winning another World Series.
That was Blanker's question to Duquette yesterday whenever he asked him, would you trade one of these young starters, Christian Javier, Luis Garcia, for an offensive player, a bat that's going to help? We were talking about Mancini there, but you can insert the offensive player. So we'll ask you that, Hive, 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Because, look, if you're going to trade for an offensive player, it's probably going to sting a little bit, right? It takes two to tango.
I think it's supposed to if you want to get quality, right?
Yeah.
You can't just get and not give something.
Unless you're dealing with Bill O'Brien, that's the way it should be.
Right, and then you're getting fleeced, and you're not getting anything but the red ass. But, yeah, I mean, when trades are made that really help you, you do have to part with something that means something to you, whether it be now or in the future, in order to get what you need to help you now.
Would you be willing to trade Christian Javier or Luis Garcia for an offensive player, even if that offense, like, it's a clear upgrade here we're talking about. Yeah. Let's set the scene. You're getting a starting caliber player. You're getting somebody that's going to be like your three-hole, six-hole hitter. Like, you're getting a significant offensive player, not like a Hall of Famer, maybe not even an all-star, but you're getting a bat that's going to help this offense out. And it might be a rental. It might be for 3 months. It might be for the rest of the 2022 season. Would you trade Christian Javier or Luis Garcia for that type of player?
I would Christian Javier before I would trade Luis Garcia, because Luis Garcia is a starter. That's what he's going to be. That's where he has the most value. That is the most valuable. Because you've used Javier both ways, because I don't know that Javier, even if he gets back to being stretched out and only focuses on being a starter, I don't know that I feel like he's a horse-type starting pitcher. And I believe that the value goes down a little bit there. And because you have a surplus of other starters that are going to get you through what you need to do. I could part with Javier if it meant that I was getting a bat that was going to be very reliable. You know, and I think Mancini fits that bill. I mean, he is the kind of guy with his versatility, not only where the positions he can play, but the fact that he can hit for pop, he can hit for average, he can do a lot of things that can make you better. I just believe that that's the kind of move that I would be willing to make, and I wouldn't even think twice about it.
I think that you usually lean more win now, where I usually lean more sustained winner. I think you look more at the tree than look at the forest, and I don't think either way is wrong. I think it's just a difference of philosophy and opinion. Mm-hmm. And I hesitate a lot to trade. I would consider both of those guys, like you said, that neither one you really consider a horse, and you would lean more Javier than Garcia because he's kind of been tinkered with, has pitched in the rotation.
I said, I don't think Javier's a horse.
You think Garcia can be a
horse?
I think
he can be. I mean, as he's now getting into this new twilight zone of innings pitched for a year, I think that he can prove to be a guy that eats up innings and is very effective.
See, I think Javier could do that too. If you just committed to the fact of, okay, you're going to be in the rotation. But I really see both of those as the same echelon of guy. I mean, you look at their numbers over the course of their career, they're both 25 years old. Mm-hmm. So they're both in their mid-20s. They both have ERAs under 3.5. So, like, I think they're both, like, future number two, number three level starters. Do I think either one could win a Cy Young in their day or be an ace of a staff? I lean probably not. So you kind of have two of the same guy here, and where I'm usually like, I'm not trading away a 25-year-old starting pitcher who's a middle-of-the-rotation guy, who is cheap, who has club control for a while for a rental. Like, I'm not going to trade one of those guys for 3 months of Trey Mancini, 3 months of Josh Bell, 3 months of Wilson Contreras for the Chicago Cubs. But because you do have a surplus in the staff, like, we don't know about Lance McCullers, but even if you want to eliminate Lance from this conversation, you still got Justin Verlander and Framber Valdez at the top. You still have one of the two guys that you wouldn't trade out of this scenario. So let's just keep Luis Garcia for the sake of the conversation. You still have Overeasy coming back. You still have Ozzie Urquidy, who you're hoping is going to get better after he abandoned the cutter. And then you also have Hunter Brown, a young starting pitcher who maybe he's not even going to pitch for the Astros until next year.
And you can find back into the rotation starters a whole hell of a lot easier and a lot cheaper in a lot of cases. And there's going to be guys that want to play for a winning team, too, to where you can go out and get those guys in free agency as opposed to these guys, the homegrown guys, you have a surplus of. And if it can bring you a bat, and Mancini, weren't we talking about the fact that he's got a year or two left?
He has a mutual option after this season.
Okay, because I would like to think that they would do what was necessary to keep him around if you went out and got a guy like that. I think that if you're looking at a Bell, I don't know that I'd be willing to give up a Javier for a Bell. I just don't think he's good enough.
Yeah, he's an upgrade over Yuli. Is he worth a mid-20 pitcher who's sub-3.5 guy? Probably
not. That's where I might not. And the reason why I think when you were talking about our philosophical differences in making a move like this is because, you know, it's a situation-by-situation, case-by-case basis. But the thing that's always kind of proven to me is, unless you're talking about the Bregman for sale that was just like a massive subject on this station forever and a day, because A.J. Hoffman was just willing to give up Bregman in a song to get Chris Sale and got just a world of feedback. That's the one exception. But other than that, for the most part, the bandwagon I've been on is, sure, you could be a top prospect. Sure, you could be a bonus baby with a big name. But a lot of times those guys don't pan out. You just don't know. There's a lot of question marks and just in terms of uncertainty. Whereas the guy you're getting is a bona fide proven guy that is going to be plugged into your lineup immediately and help you knowing that he's been effective on the major league level.
My pushback to that's always going to be that the Astros are built with homegrown talent. So, like, even where you're going to have some misses in terms of some prospects that come up, if your philosophy is still to be, like, to build based on homegrown, I mean, the Astros homegrew Jose Altuve. Alex Bregman was homegrown. Peña Correa, both homegrown. George Springer, Kyle Tucker. You can make the case Yordan Alvarez was traded for, but you built him up through your minor league system. And then you look at the pitching staff, Fromber, Luis Garcia, Christian Javier. So, like, I'm okay being pro-prospect and being, like, a little bit hesitant to trading those guys because I do believe that the long-term sustained way to win in baseball is to homegrow your talent and to win with cheap labor.
And just because you sometimes go out of your norm of regularity to try and make a move that makes a difference, yeah. I don't think you get away from being homegrown. I just go back and start referring back to the guys that have been moved for big moves sure. in the past, in the Greinke deal, in the Cole deal, in a lot of the deals, and you go, you know what? For the most part, why wouldn't you do that 10 times out of 10?
Yeah, and a lot of times, too, it's like where you have a surplus of. Like, Abraham Toro was very easy to trade last year because he's not going to play third over Bregman.
There's no room anywhere on that roster for him.
Yeah, so I kind of looking at it from that aspect as well.
De La Cruz, too, they kind of stumbled on him. He wasn't one of their top-rated prospects. He got red hot in AAA, and you thought, hey, guess what? Now I got a resource I can trade that I didn't have before to get someone on the major league level that can help me now.
I like that, too. I like the idea of, one, trading players that are blocked, even like decent prospects, and trying to find something for them. And then the fringe players who you really don't think are going to be long-term good players, they're just having a hot first 6 months of the season and flipping like somebody that can help you as well. 713-780-ESPN. What do you think, Houston? Would you be willing to let go of a mid-20-year-old starting pitcher, sub-3.5 ERA, that has the potential to be a number three starter on every big league team? Whether it's Javier, whether it's Garcia, would you be willing to ship one of those pitchers out because you have a surplus in the starting rotation for an offensive bat that helps you that might even be a rental? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. We continue the discussion when we return. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5.
To call into the HRNP listener line, dial 713-780-ESPN. Administration of employee benefits is a hassle. Let HRNP eliminate those burdens and save you money. Visit HRP.net today. Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Would you be willing to trade one of your young starting pitchers for an offensive rental for the next few months? Tough question. Jim Duquette, we had him on yesterday. We'll get to Chuck in just a minute. Here's what Jim Duquette talked about. I asked about Trey Mancini. This isn't so much about Mancini. I do like Trey Mancini. But Duquette summed up the answer to what, like, everybody wants to trade a couple of lower-level prospects that we've never heard of for a significant offensive bat. Not realistic. This is what realistic Jim Duquette, former GM, told us.
When, you know, this year, outside of the early part of the season, he looks like he's back. And he does have, you know, he's not perfect in left field, but he's good at first. He can DH, and he'll catch what he gets to in left. And he's the perfect guy. Like, you know, right-hand bat in that ballpark. He's a great makeup guy. I've known Trey there for a while. My cousin, when he was the GM of the Orioles, you know, brought him up there, and he's grown into one of the good dudes in the game, but also one of the top players. And I think they're going to make him available. They didn't get what they were looking for last year. Not that it's going to be like you're not going to have to give up a top two or three prospect in your organization, but it's going to hurt to get him. And I think that he is going to be available.
And that's the part that I wanted to you know, listen to again from Duquette, because I am pro Mancini. I would like the idea of Mancini.
You're the first one on that train that I know of.
And you look at some of the peripheral numbers, like his ball flight suits Minute Maid Park very well, whatever. Like, I don't want to dive into that rabbit hole about Mancini. The conversation is, would you be willing to, because that's what inspired the conversation to me, because he's like, it's going to hurt. So what's going to hurt without trading a top 2-3 prospect? It would be trading a mid-20-year-old Christian Javier, mid-20-year-old Luis Garcia. So would you do that for an offensive bat? 713-780-ESPN. And a rental at that, 713-780-3776.
And it's worth saying, too, just to what Duquette was saying, that is the opposite of Yankee Stadium in terms of...
Oh, it's Yellowstone.
They have extended the walls. Even Aaron Judge bitching about just the wide-open spaces in that outfield. It's like the old Astrodome days with... with Baggy and Biggio going, what if they had played at Minute Maid? If you could take Mancini and take him out of that ballpark and you could put it from Camden Yards, put him in Minute Maid Park, you got to believe his numbers are going to explode.
All right, I didn't want to go baseballsavant.com, but since you took me down that path, he has 6 home runs this year as a member of the Baltimore Orioles playing in Camden Yellowstone Park. If you were just to take his ball flight, stat, you know, cast, all this stuff, if you had took every single one of his at-bats and put him in Minute Maid Park, he'd have 16 home runs this year.
That's what I'm talking about.
He plays for Minute Maid Park. His ball flight is suited for this ballpark. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Let's go out to the HRMP listener line. Chuck, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees. What's going on, Chuck?
What's going on, fellas? Welcome back, Joel.
Chuckster.
I just wanted to tell you, you absolutely do not trade any pitchers. Look, I give it another month. I'm not ready to give up on the offense. I'd rather see him tinker with the offensive lineup, mostly getting Bregman out of third and just trying to tinker with that. I do not want to trade for anybody right now because I think you're going to have to pay for Verlander again at the end of the season.
Yeah.
If he continues like this, there's never an abundance of arms.
Chuck, you really believe that this offense is going to break out of it? Do you really believe this offense is going to break out of it?
I have more faith that they will get better than I do that they will stay the same. Well, I say break out of it, maybe not break out of it, but these guys are not career hitters like they're hitting now.
Yeah.
I think they will get some semblance of that. And, you know, like I said, you tinker with the lineup, you might have a little more. Guys, love the show, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chuck.
That was deep. That was deep from Chuck. I agree with Chuck, because if you look at the peripheral numbers outside of just runs scored per game, the Astros, their on-base percentage is fine. Their slugging percentage is fine. You still have dudes that are, like, legitimate Major League Baseball hitters. We're talking about Yordan Alvarez potentially being one of the best hitters in baseball. That's going to lead to a very good offense. Tucker, Altuve, Pena, although he's walking around with some little, like, soft cast on his wrist, which kind of scares me.
Well, he's on the IL, so they got time to make sure he keeps it immobile, to make sure he heals quicker.
Well, I didn't love
it's
seeing
just,
that.
Jeremy, it's just discomfort. That's all it is. It's just discomfort.
The nasty D word. But, you know, I think Chuck's in, like, onto something with the lineup. Like, you have 6 weeks before the trade deadline to, like, figure out if you need to trade a Christian Javier or Luis Garcia for a starter. So if it's something that you think could be helped by switching up the lineup. You know that I love the Bregman-Altuve flip-flop idea. Get an on-base guy at the top, get a slugger in the middle. But even if it's like Bregman to the six hole, whatever. Like, this is the time to be doing that stuff because you need to collect information over the next 6 weeks to determine if you need to make a significant move of trading a mid-20-year-old starter for a huge bat.
This would be the information-gathering process of the trial, right? This is where, you know, because I always say get out ahead of it, but no matter how much you want a team to get out of ahead of it before the trade frenzy starts going and we get, you know, really all ramped up getting up to the deadline on August 2nd, you do realize this is the time to do your intel. This is the time to do your deep dives and start looking at things and just set up possible scenarios. The best general managers have scenarios set up with multiple teams, and then at a further point down the road, they can say, okay, now we've had this happen or this happen on our club, which means we're going to lean more towards these two deals as opposed to if we continued to struggle offensively, we'd be leaning towards these two deals. Because the one thing Brendan and I were talking about this morning, because last year, if you remember, instead of Trey Mancini, this was all about Cedric Mullins. This was all about getting a center fielder that was a 300-hitting center fielder on a team that really wasn't going to be good by the time he had seen his peak and gone, and maybe it would be time to move on from him. I'd be willing to throw the question out to you guys, and I don't know where you sit on this, but if you were willing to give up one of those two starters for a Trey Mancini, if they said, we'll throw Mullins in, but you got to throw us Jake Myers, and you got to throw us at least one or two of your prospects from down in Sugarland, would you be willing to part with either a Brown or a Leon or something else, Jake Myers and one of those starters, and you get Mullins? So basically you have cemented center field, and you get Mancini, and for the short term, you have cemented another big bat no matter what Yuli does.
Problem is, Mullins hasn't been very good this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's different from last year to this year.
Last year is a different player than this year, although that's the case for Major League Baseball as a whole, right, because of the balls. But last year, I mean, Cedric Mullins last year was a top 10 MVP guy. This year, his numbers aren't as nearly as good. He's hitting .250, on base .307, slugging .385, OPS under .700. So that makes it very difficult for me to, like, throw in some Jake Myers, to throw in like a significant prospect, because now you're looking at you're mortgaging a lot of your young players.
But based on what you've seen of Myers and the fact that at least you know Mullins could play quality center field in the majors, I think I'd still consider doing that.
Yeah, I'm probably out on that one. I think that's, again, that like the difference we were talking about with the philosophy. Because, I mean, Myers last year as a rookie had a 761 OPS, which was much higher than Mullins'
but
692 right now.
We saw Jekyll and Hyde. We saw early on he was hitting home runs, which he wasn't known for, and doing everything you wanted him to do offensively. And then the second go-around before he got hurt, he was a different player, and it was not as good a player.
Mm-hmm. But I think we're seeing Jekyll and Hyde with Mullins, too.
True. That's fair.
That's kind of my hang-up. Like, if Mullins was having the season now that he had last year, now you have my attention. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Would you trade Garcia, Javier, mid-20-year-old starter currently, both have career ERAs under 350, for an offensive bat rental that could bolt you in free agency at the end of the year? Because it's going to be hard. It's going to sting if you make that trade to help this offense. And to Chuck's point as well, like, I do think the offense can get better. But he talked about you can never have enough pitching, which I actually agree with.
It's always been the case, yeah.
James Click talks about how Jim Crane is a very, like, pitching-first guy, because he was a pitcher in college. And James Click always refers to what Jim Crane tells him, saying that you can't lose a shutout. So, like, it's emphasis to pitching with this team. And it'd be hard to trade one of those guys. But you do have a surplus of that. I want to know, like, I'm not willing to do that right now, if I'm being honest with you. I'm not willing to trade Garcia and Javier right now, June 17th. But if I get to July 27th and Yuli still looks washed and doesn't look like he's going to be the player that he's going to be, if Alex Bregman, if I'm wrong and he doesn't snap out of this like I think he's going to, if my pitching staff is still healthy.
But we're only trading one of them, right? We're either trading one or the other.
Right.
Because the other thing is, aside from everything you just said about internal, the other thing is you got to weigh the landscape too. If it looks like there's even more competition or other teams make moves to make them better, mm-hmm. it may cause you to make a move that you wouldn't otherwise make.
Yeah, see, that's why I need the next 6 weeks mm-hmm. before I'm willing to trade Luis Garcia, Christian Javier. Because, like, knock on wood, I don't want to say this, but if Justin Verlander bust up his UCL, like, this is off the table.
Yeah.
Like,
don't do anything then, because basically your chances are off the
table. Or if Lance McCullers has a setback and doesn't pitch in 2022, that makes me more hesitant to make that type of trade as well. 7-1, so that, again, I need the 6 weeks. I'm not ready to do this on June 17th. Now, July 27th, if the landscape is ideal,
You also don't want to. You got to gauge the market to say,
sure.
I don't want to do it when all of a sudden the iron gets red hot and suddenly now there's multiple suitors yeah. for the guys that I was pursuing.
713-780-3776. Brandon T saying, I'm okay with trading Javier. Someone else has to step up. Martinez has done that this year. And like you said, you could bring up Hunter Brown if need be. Look, I like what we've seen from Martinez in the long mm-hmm. relief role. I don't think he's going to be a starting pitcher in this rotation,
I don't
really,
think so
ever.
Either. No, so, I think he is where he's going to be when it comes to a team like this. He might get some more situational relief appearances, especially if he continues to pitch the way he's pitching. But that's best case scenario for him. I don't see him being a starter or a horse or a guy that you're going to rely on in that fashion. And that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Because you need all those different roles to be filled. One other thing nitpicky, though, that I will say in terms of the two guys that you're going to trade, the other thing that worries me about Javier is there's a lot of whip to his elbow. There's a lot of, in terms of his throwing motion and his delivery, it's a lot more, and I don't want to say unconventional, but it does get a lot out there where his body is in relation to the torque on his elbow and stuff, and that would concern me. That's why I'd be more willing to go that route than Garcia.
It's just so hard to predict injuries. Like, Mark Pryor was like, oh, he's got the perfect fundamentals, and then his arm was destroyed by the time he was like 30. Jordan says, I truly believe that Javier has perennial all-star potential, even more so than Garcia, and I love Garcia. I think he's been yo-yoed from bullpen to starter his whole career, has been more effective in both roles. He's a killer given some continuity. I think he's a star. See, I think Javier and Garcia both have the same potential. I both think that they could be high-end starters. I'm not sure either one could be ace. I think they could both be number two starters on really good teams, and that's why it is a hard question to ask. Would you trade one of them for a rental
bat? A lot
of
times the Javier thing relates to how we relate to the Texans' offensive line. And if you could just leave Javier in one role and one role only and continue on a daily basis to just hone that craft, we might be talking about him in a whole different light. But because he's done you a favor by being, you know, moved back and forth musical mm-hmm. chair-wise, we probably haven't maximized who he could be in either role.
No, I don't think we have. I think it's a good point. 0754, maybe Breggy should start doing mound visits. Maybe that will bring back the swagger. That's a brilliant idea. I completely agree. I think we should see that from Alex Breggy.
Pizza and beer for Yuli. Mound visits for Breggy. Problem solved, people. Go on with your weekend.
We fixed it. 713-780-3776. Would you trade Garcia? Would you trade Javier for a rental bat? Let us know. When we come back, Sam Amico, senior NBA writer for HoopsWire.com. He's going to join us next. to talk about the NBA Finals, to talk about the current plight of the Houston Rockets. That's next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5.
Who's this?
Hey, this is Trey Wingo. You're listening to ESPN 97.5, Houston. Hello.